Hi, everybody. My name is Sandy Brown Jensen, and I'm a writing instructor and faculty technology specialist at Lane Community College here in Eugene, Oregon. I specialize in digital storytelling. I'm also a public radio talk show host for a visual arts review program. I chose the topic of dreams because I'm fascinated by how vital dreaming is to the human story. Almost all of us dream, both asleep and awake. An experienced teacher I know says he doesn't write class plans. He dreams a little dream before class. And that is what will happen. I direct most of my life that way. We live our lives on an aquifer of dreams. Let's talk about that. Life is a difficult assignment. I think talking about dreams is very important. People love to share their dreams. What are yours? Remember, there are sleeping dreams, intuitive waking dreams, daydreaming, and of course, dreaming your future. As we enter this conversation together, I think anything goes at first until we pull our collective ideas together. I'm so looking forward to working with all of you.
Tune to the S106, time for a dream. Just close your eyes, give your ears, and dream. Brought to you from Tunis, the S106, we dream together. نحلموا مع بعضنا, on rêve ensemble.
Hello, this is Sandy Brown Jensen for DS106. Welcome to our program on dream spaces. Today I'm interviewing Karen Orr Levine from Brownsville, Oregon. Karen and I both work at Lane Community College. She teaches adult basic education, and I teach English and digital storytelling. And today we want to talk about the provocative topic of dreams. Mm-hmm. And Karen was telling me something very interesting about her early dream experiences. Could you talk about those, Karen?
Yes, I can, Sandy. Thanks for having me. Sorry. When I was a child, I remember about 5 years old, I had an image of what I wanted to be when I was 19. That's my earliest memory of how I walk into dreams. When I was 19, I turned around, I remembered that dream that I had, that daydream, that's who I wanted to be, and I realized that I'd fulfilled that five-year-old's image. And so I looked back at that five-year-old, and I felt this connection with that person. And it seems that I have since then just walked into my dreams a lot. My life keeps happening as though it's a realization or manifestation of a dream that I've had before. And that just ties to me. That's consciousness. Make a consciousness, I guess, looking mm-hmm. back at and connecting with the person I used to be all the way through.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that called also far-seeing.
Oh.
People have the ability to see, get glimpses of the future that they're going to grow into, mm-hmm. or perhaps it's an optional path.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, it happens in that liminal space between waking and sleeping. You called it a daydream, but it is really a dream space,
mm-hmm.
Out of which I believe we experience flow, we experience artistic drive of all different kinds, mm-hmm. plus these, you know, frankly, somewhat mystical experiences of ourselves and others mm-hmm. In kind of a time warp. I was really interested in what you had to say about mega consciousness. It reminds me of, isn't there a spiritual path in which our human life is seen as a dream of God. I think you have some thoughts about that as well, right?
Yes, I do. I think that my early experiences made me open to the ideas of maybe the Indian mysticism, notions of reincarnation and dream. And so I became interested in the writings of Meher Baba when I was just a teenager, I think. And if I could quote one thing that he says about dreams.
Absolutely.
In the dream state, you enjoy and suffer. When you wake, you realize that your enjoyment and suffering was nothing but a dream, an illusion. But know that your present state of consciousness, which you call being awake, when compared to the real awake state, is nothing but a dream state. Your life is a dream within the mighty dream of God, which is the universe.
Hmm.
So the dream of God is our universe, our reality. And our consciousness is God's experiencing that,
mm-hmm.
that dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's on a microcosm when we catch ourselves realizing our own dreams, that's like connecting to also to that mega consciousness of God realizing his dream, himself dreaming.
I think I had an experience of that once on a smaller scale. I think I've written about it. When I was a young teacher and I first entered into a classroom, not first, but I've been teaching for a few months, but it was definitely my first class at the University of California, Riverside. And I had this creative writing class, and things were just going great. It was an evening class. But there was lots going on, lots of give and take. And I remember at one point, I just slipped into this other state of consciousness, and I felt suddenly that everybody in the room was part of my dream, part of my consciousness, as if each student was informing the larger dream or consciousness, which I was directing.
Hmm.
It sounds sort of like a power trip, but it wasn't like that at all. Hmm. It was just a distinct experience of the whole classroom as being part of my consciousness. Hmm. And I have to say that's never really left me. When I'm in front of a class, everybody there is inside of me and part of my dream.
Hmm.
And it's part of what, quote-unquote, controls a classroom. But it's quite magical, hmm. and it is dreamlike, as you say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, Sandy. Charting consciousness, you know, it's we watch ourselves. We can connect with ourselves over time. We can connect with the people around us, and it's like a magical thing. Our conscious mind,
mm-hmm.
you know. I love to think of it as a dream. And I was reading in Rumi a poem that I think speaks to this really well.
I love Rumi.
Okay, let me.
Yes, I'm sure everybody does. Please.
This is the Coleman Parks Rumi, Essential Rumi, and it's called "The Dream That Must Be Interpreted." This place is a dream; only a sleeper considers it real. Then death becomes like dawn, and you wake up laughing at what you thought was your grief. But there's a difference with this dream. Everything cruel and unconscious, done in the illusion of the present world, all that does not fade away at the death waking. It stays, and it must be interpreted. All the mean laughing, all the quick sexual wanting, those torn coats of Joseph, they change into powerful wolves that you must face. The retaliation that sometimes comes now, the swift payback hit, is just a boy's game to what the other will be. You know about circumcision here. It's full castration there. And this groggy time we live, this is what it's like. A man goes to sleep in the town where he has always lived, and he dreams he's living in another town. In the dream, he doesn't remember the town he's sleeping in his... Nah. In the dream, he doesn't remember the town he's sleeping in his bed in. He believes the reality of the dream town. The world is that kind of sleep. The dust of many crumbled cities settles over us like a forgetful doze, but we are older than those cities. We began as a mineral. We emerged into plant life and into the animal state and then into human being, and always we have forgotten our former states, except in early spring when we slightly recall being green again.
Great.
That's how a young person turns toward a teacher. That's how a baby leans toward the breast without knowing the secret of its desire, yet turning instinctively. Humankind is being led along an evolving course through this migration of intelligences, and though we seem to be sleeping, there is an inner wakefulness that directs the dream and that will eventually startle us back to the truth of who we are.
What a wonderful poem, Karen.
Isn't it beautiful?
Have you read that many times to yourself?
I read it quite a while ago, and I just picked it up when you started this story, this thinking about dreams again, and it is a good reflection of my take of the universe, of creation, of what we're doing here. We're God's consciousness evolving through this dream until we are finally awake.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Do you know Robert Moss? He's a contemporary dream master, I would call. I had just bought a book of his called, and the book is called Here Everything is Dreaming.
Oh, that's perfect.
I think that's a great place to stop.
Okay.
You've been listening to Dream Spaces on DS106 Radio Internet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Sandy Brown Jensen, broadcasting from Eugene, Oregon, at the end of the Oregon Trail. You're listening to the dreamy sound of DS106. That's DS as in dreams. Please join the dream team as we get a global perspective on the dreamscape so common and yet so strange to us all. Tune in for Dreamscape on DS106 Internet Radio. That's DS106 live on your radio dial. Stay tuned for dreams.
Who doesn't dream? Who isn't intrigued by a dream he or she dreamt? Who didn't try to wake up in the middle of the night, caught in a nightmare? Everybody dreams. But we all perceive dreams the same way. Today in our Dream Space 106, our dream team is spotting the light on dreams, each from his or her own perspective. From Tunisia, I'm Haifa Majdoub, your DS106 radio show speaker, and I'll tell you more about dreams as they are perceived in my culture. In my country, and in the Middle East in general, dreams are rooted in religious beliefs. As such, they are divided into three categories: good dreams or visions, and they are from God, a kind of supernatural perception; bad dreams, and they are from the evil. And Muslims do some practices after waking from those dreams. They would turn, for instance, to the other side if they were sleeping on their right side. The third category is about the dreams from oneself. Now, the question is, how to draw the line between the three categories? I mean, how do you know that your dream is a good dream or a vision, or if it is a dream from evil, or if it is oneself, a dream of oneself? Well, you know that your dream is a good dream or a vision when it happens in those times, before dawn, just before or after a prayer, or when your dream or vision is short and clear and you wake up quickly. Your vision or a dream is easy to remember and remains impressed with all its details in one's memory. There are also symbols in dreams that makes it possible to interpret them. For instance, when you dream of a dead person, then in the dream you go with him or her, then this means that your end is near. I remember once when I dreamt of my grandmother who was dead, asking me to go with her. I told her to go and that I will follow. I didn't go with her. Thank God, and I'm still alive. Waking up from this dream, I told it to my sister, And we laughed at the fact of being cautious in life and even in dreams. The dreams you can control are lucid dreams. For the dream that I mentioned, I knew I was dreaming and that a dead person in one's dream meant the dreamer's near end. That's intriguing. Where's the borderline between dreams and reality? Could we control our dreams? The dream world is so mysterious and we merely know a little about it. Is it possible to decipher its code after a group of scientists succeeded in inventing a machine able to read people's dreams and transform them into images? Sounds science fiction. But no, that's reality. Who knows? Maybe after such an invention, we will be able to unveil what the dream world hides and have the answers to all our questions.
Welcome to Dream Space. Dream, that's the thing to do. Have you found yourself walking into your own dreams? I have. My dreams become reality. But whose dream is it? Some share my faith. It's God dreaming the universe, and we are his eyes, watching it all go down. Come to Dream Space on DS106 Radio.
This is Sandy Brown Jensen, and you're listening to DS106 Radio. I'm here to tell you about a dream I had, and this dream is called Blue Ronald Running. I dreamed the pony had come to take me home to the future. In that dream, we were all sleeping outside in our airlifts, and Kales came around to shake each of us awake to see the Austro Borealis in the southern sky. "Look south," he had signed. There was no moon for this planet, so the shimmering waves of whipped yellow, scarlet, imperishable green over the bulky shadows of the day rings were dramatic. I had hoisted Tip Top onto my shoulders and climbed the plank platform the kids had built in the rigger tree for a better look. Gemstone clambered right behind and curled up in my lap. I rubbed my cheek against Tip Top's soft gray fur, and the tiny Gemstone wiggled in the crook of my elbow. Kales and Mops stood close to each other, leaning on the Ronald fence. Mops's bright red wires wavered into purple and orange in the strange firelight. The Ronald caught the linden flower scent of our watching and turned as one on the far side of the field. From my treehouse perch, I could see the massive outlines of individual bodies melt into the moving flow of one as Ronald thundered straight at the fence, eyes silver and intelligent against their fine cobalt heads, the inky tracery of pattern on hot skin scrolling as they ran like a message being told, too fast to read. Kales and Mops didn't flinch. They knew this Ronald trick of old. At the last possible second, the liquefied Ronald spiraled into cerulean pinwheel, slowed, shifted into individuals. "Hey, Ronald, hey, Ronald," Kales murmured, putting out a hand for one azure shoulder to lean into. We all settled together to stare in silence at the rare lights undulating over the southern skies. When the great display shook one last sheet of silken yellow across the horizon and then faded, we went back to sleep. When I woke again, I swear it was no dream. The sleek saucer and cup-shaped craft sliced delicately across the pale blue of the Ronald pasture. The burnished gleam of its time-shift paint glowed red and gold as it settled lightly on the surface. My heart gave that unique double beat I learned was the physicality of joy. I could see the familiar shapes of the pony beaming out at me from the observation hall that circled the craft like a transparent necklace joining the cup and saucer halves. A face like a star with its five smiling points, the two-light twinkle of a crescent, the long triple twist curved bottled shape with racing neon circuits of welcome. My pony, come at last, to take me home to our future. Everyone woke up then, Kales, Mops, Tip Top, and Gemstone. At first, they stood there with their mouths open, but when they saw me racing across the yard, flipping horizontal through the flats of the Ronald fence, they were right behind me, these good people who had taken me in so very long ago. Only Mops and Kales remembered when I had been left to their care. Those mares had long ceased haunting me, those old dreams of purple and bruised pain, of screaming and having no tongue, of the pursuing dire wolf who always caught up with me in the end and took me by the throat. The children, Tip Top and Gemstone, who ran with us to the glorious returning Pomy craft, were a new generation who hadn't known I was different. I never spoke. What of that? It had always been that way. I never grew older, the eternal sister. The dear Pomy flung open the light doors, and we all crowded into the broad, circular observation hall. I was surrounded by touches, textures, gentle smells, and colors of Pomy greeting. All in one, they said, you are one in all. Hey, look, cried Tip Top, the small and gray furry. We're flying now. Lift me up, Gemstone demanded, crawling halfway up Kales's leg. Ow, he said, unhooking her before he suctioned the back of her neck and lifted her onto the silver time bar. Then he caught his breath. There's our house, and the Ronalds are running after us. Look, Gemstone, they look like a river of blue. We all pushed up against the windows and peered out. The landscape peeled out below us like the fine veining you see in the back of a rigger tree leaf. Ronald wore a thread of sapphire flowing like a liquid stream across the hills, trying to keep us in sight. We lifted higher, and Wildport Husk shrank to a circulating yellow light. Home, I thought, then pushed the thought away more quickly than it had come. My home was in the future. The Pomy were my people. I had meant Wildport Husk to be a storm stop only. Mops's red wires wavered, signing south to me, so that I saw then the Austral Borealis come back into view, liming the unfolding landscape. The hills of Wildport Husk rippled up to the dark shapes of the day rings. I turned to Star Pomy, and I had no need of this soft tongue that had never worked after the dire wolf killed it in a mare when it was first new. My heart opened like a linden flower, and I said in the high verse of our language, how good it is to be going home. Tell me of our victory, of the future of Pomy, citadel of my birth and childhood, how it was I was remembered on this far and distant planet. What message, what song? Then the grief came in waves, and there was no other way to prepare me for the thoughtful, slow reply of Star Pomy. Chilra, the bright citadel, is fallen to the ground. Pomy have no longer any shelter or oracular laurel tree or speaking fountain. Even the vocal stream has ceased to flow. Chilra, we have no future to return to. We have all of now, and we have only part of the past. Crescent Pomy caught hold of my eyes with those twin gleams so hard that some old understanding passed through me, shuddering this soft textured body with a cold wind. In a moment, I had it all. No, I cried out and grasped the silver time bar that ran around the ob hall. I shook it, trying to feel the ultraviolet pulses of the future that had always run through it, undulating with familiarity, promise, memory of a future life. But Crescent Pomy was right. The speaking current, like me, could no longer talk. The past pulses were there in dashes and darts, the way the green river of recall is said to run. Only the bright stream of now ran firm and full-bodied, silver and blue as a longfish beneath my hands. Neon Palmy tried to slow the flow of images from my body differences, but they came like curling paper in a hot flame, flying up into nothingness, places and names and memories long ago in a future world, now fresh, now torched in the image fire, now gone in the ember wind. Time future sizzled backward to the now, and I saw the time block that Direwolf had built not so far from here. No future time, no home to home to. The soft body that evolved here on Wildport was built to pull gasping grief inward. How it courses in pain through the heart and bowels, wrings the mind, and how the salty tears wet the knees when doubled over on the floor. This body is meant to cry out, but I could not cry out the pain of losing all I held future dear. Pomi did not touch me, for they did not know how my body would curl and shake, double into itself. But our grief flowed into one. They gave me anxious gleams and textures, the scent of sandalwood. It was Mops who turned away from the window and ran to kneel by me. Chilraw, she said, laying her thousand red wires on my shoulder. Chilraw, what is it? These people have their own intuitions, their ancient ways of knowing, even shifted shape anomalies like me. Kales and Mops had picked me up years ago out of the Ronald pasture, no questions asked, after it was clear I could not answer, and they took me into their own river burrow in the Wildport called Husk. Arrows of pain darted through my abdomen as I uncurled myself. Mops suctioned me under one green patterned arm and helped me to my feet. My knuckles felt old, although they could not age, as I signed to her that all was lost. The future, I said, was gone. These the last of the Pomi, and they adrift like space vagabonds, they who were always so heart-bound to the hills and suns of Pomi. Her red wires quivered, puzzled. Kales, Tip-Top, Gemstone, come over here. We need to have a council. So there we were, high over the day rings, having a council with the Pomi. It seemed strange as a dream to have these two parts of my life meet each other, seek for a way to speak, discuss a problem for its best solution. Many times had I sat in just such a council ring in Wildport Husk, thinking together with the town folk how best to rotate a crop, rig a weir, solve a funny love triangle. Now, as then, Kales and Mops and I signed back and forth like crazy. Only this time I was interpreting from my own heart language into the logics of theirs. Finally, they seemed to grasp the problem, and Mops, as usual, had the solution. Come back to Wildport Husk with us, she said, pragmatic, then turned to the Pomi. And what of you, good folk? Can you not stay with us? Pomi lights quivered in confusion. This had not occurred to any of us, and we had borrowed future grief of our parting already. I was not a successful example for Pomi because I was a one-light sun. I have been able to focus, consolidate, become one among the many of the Wildport people. Even if voiceless as the dire wolf gave chase through my mares, I had hands and I could sign. I had no age, but that had gone unnoticed. But Pomi was many. My option was not theirs. Leave me now for a moment, Neon Pomi said, for I am honored and full of thought. Can Pomi live in Wildport Husk? I must think. I turned to the window with Mops, rough Kales held Tip-Top, tiny Gemstone up on the time bar, toes curled around it, reaching one claw to my shoulder for balance. The vast plains of clock melted over the edge of a table cliff and disappeared as the craft, silent and sleek, slipped through the night. We ran all the way to the water fields before I noticed a curving back of our trajectory. The stars blurred, the colors of the austral borealis smeared, the green phosphorus of the water field crackled beneath us as we curved, and I knew some return had been plotted in the map room ahead. Homie came among us. Tip Top squealed as he was lifted up to the tip of Crescent Pomy, and Gemstone continued balanced on the time rail, held now in delicate place by the outpoints of Star Pomy. We are no more than time tramps now, Neon Pomy touched me, and that will not do for who we are, what we have loved. Pomy will come to Wildport Husk with you and make a form, a place, a story, a history with you. What have you chosen? What will you be? I cried in my own way, the emotion of home folk big in my chest. My pomy now are the running blue ronnel. I go to the fence and call them by name, Star, Crescent, Neon. They rub their great silent heads against me, closing their liquid eyes in pleasure, and we speak in the old way, heart to heart, as pomy have always talked. Gemstone and Tip Top grew, and their children's children came to my unchanging care. Each learned to ride the blue ronnel, to care for the lovely beasts, to learn the lessons they would need to take us into this very particular future, this very local Wildport Husk future, no other. In my dream, the blue ronnel run in a singular turquoise dream. I am astride in my permeable soft flesh, low cheek to hot neon blue flesh. And now, only tonight, only in this place, they are my tongue, and we speak blue pastures. That concludes our dream program for tonight. You've been listening to Karen Levine of Brownsville, Oregon, on How We Are the Dreaming Mind of God. Haifa Majoub from Tunisia, on dream traditions of her culture. And me, Sandy Brown Jensen, reading an original science fiction story based on a dream I had as a child. Thank you for listening to Dreamscape 106. Sweet dreams, everyone.